Good morning to you. I'm going to try this softly so I don't wake anybody up, but what do you do when the bell rings 2 minutes early? Welcome to this absolutely splendid day. I don't know if you have the same reaction, but went out to feed my chickens early and it was cool. And I thought, wow, this is a great day. Beautiful day in Alabama, and hope you are well, and welcome to this Bible study hour. And we're in the Gospel of John, chapter 11 and chapter 13. This is kind of a walk through the Gospel of John. We are awaiting the return of Brother Scott to the class, and I'm saving some choice pieces for him. Like, for example, I left 10 behind. I'm leaving 12 behind today. There's a reason why I'm connecting these two chapters. We're in 11. We're picking up where we left off last time, in the moment of the raising of Lazarus, and discussing another important aspect of an event that John, thank God for John. Why do we need four gospel writers? Well, here's reason number 422, because he recorded this event of the raising of Lazarus in such a way that is just a blessing to those of us today that have the privilege to read it. And also, of course, chapter 13 that we're heading to, and there is a connection between the two. There's a reason for which I'm connecting chapter 11 to chapter 13 of John. God weeps and God washes. It just so happens that in English they both start with a W. In the Greek, there's no connection. There's no alliteration, but it did strike me, you know. God weeps, God cries, and God washes. See, these are probably some of the two best known of all the events in 2,000 years that the story has been told or mistold. You know, the events of God weeping and God washing feet are the best known. So we risk, again, just taking them for granted. They go right in one ear and out the other. At least that's the risk. The risk is that as we turn to it, we look at it again in a land where we're privileged to have freedom of religion, and I give thanks for that, that we take for granted that God weeps. We take for granted that God washes. When man makes up gods, he does not make up gods that weep or wash. I mean, that's just a given. And man is in the business, tragically, of making up gods ever since the fall. And there have been a bunch of them, and I can't pretend that I know the mythologies of all the man-made gods. But I know a few. And there is no god that weeps. Not with a human being, not for a human being, not as a human being. Ain't no way that we make up a god like that. Why would we? Why would we make up a god that cries? And there's definitely never a god that we make up, that human beings make up, that washes feet. It just doesn't happen. So the remarkable nature of these narratives, of these texts, of these moments in the life of Jesus, has to be absorbed and understood again and again and again, because it's just, it's just unbelievable. Should be. Should strike us as such. God weeps. Mentioned before, the gods of the Mesopotamians. That would be the civilization among which Abraham was born in the 20th century before Christ. Great cities along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers of Uruk, Lagash. They didn't make up gods that cried. In fact, here's a generic description of the gods that man makes up. In ancient times, and sometimes in modern too, they're irrational. They don't make sense. There's no justice. Forget love. They create men, say, for example, in the Babylonian story of the creation, they create you and I. You and I were made. The purpose of our life was to work this earth so that they didn't have to. That's the Babylonian explanation of why men are, so that they don't have to dig canals and they don't have to, we were made to do that. So, and the explanation of, for example, the Great Flood. All ancient cultures have a Great Flood story. Is that we were making too much noise and disturbing the gods when they were napping. Had nothing to do with sin, had everything to do with sleep. The gods sleep. Their gods sleep. They take vacations too. So when we make up gods, we do not make up gods that cry or that wash feet. And that is where I guess we can start in looking back. We looked last time at, of course, the raising of Lazarus or the events, and here is the text. We're in John chapter 11. If you're not there, and it's verse 28, I've got the ESV text up on the screen. Hopefully it's a font size that you can read from a distance. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary. Of course, this is Martha, saying in private, "The teacher is here, is calling for you." When she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. There's weeping already on the part of a sister mourning for her brother. Now, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. This is how far we got last time. For those of you that might not have been here, bring back the context so that we can proceed in the narrative here. And this is supposed to work, but it's not, so I'll switch to manual. So this is where we pick up verse 33, and we look at the famous shortest verse in the Bible, reminding you there are no verses as John writes it. And he simply puts Jesus wept in the middle of an important story. When Jesus saw her weeping, here again, weeping. She was weeping, Jesus sees her weeping. The Jews who had come with her also weeping. Here's all the mourning for a beloved person from a sister and neighbors. He was deeply moved in spirit. That's what the text says. And greatly troubled. So we get a double dose of description of what? What is going on here? John doesn't just casually say, "and he felt for him." He does not do that. What he says is, he was deeply moved in spirit. And here down on the bottom, uninspired words down at the bottom, my words, my questions to the text. I hope you bring yours. Moved by what? Jesus was moved by what? What was he moved by? Okay? Was it the fact that as sin came into the world, so did illness? And though not all sickness and illness is a result of sin, the being detached from the tree of life, the Garden of Eden, has brought death and dying as a necessity in the human condition. And it brings havoc, death does. Sometimes it's very sudden. So last week I told you my uncle died, and his funeral was yesterday, and he was 92. But this week also, as in, I'm sure, in your lives, you get news. So a young boy, 14, in Searcy, where I used to live for 19 years, Arkansas, lost. And I know his grandfather well. He was a colleague of mine. He's a professor at Harding University. And just the whole city is wearing his favorite color. They called on everybody, "Wear his favorite color," because a 14-year-old, you're not supposed to die when you're young. You're not supposed to. That's, you know, what we think. But then it happens. Then it happens. And so Jesus is moved, deeply moved, in his spirit, says the text. And then, as if that were not enough, he adds on, he doubles down, and he was greatly troubled. And the Greek word there translates, he was shaken. He was shaken. Jesus, God, was deeply moved in his spirit, and God was greatly shaken. So, some say that he was shaken because
they just didn't realize they shouldn't be mourning. Their faith was too shallow. They didn't understand that he could and would raise him from the dead. But I think they miss it. I don't think that's right. You help me out here. I think that's wrong. We're robbing, we're stealing from the text what John is trying to say, because John was there. John was there. What in the demeanor of the physical Jesus? And of course, now John is writing some 60 years later, 60 years after that. John's written in the 90s, and this happened in the 30s. So he's writing 60 years later, and he's remembering, and he's, of course, by inspiration, protected from error. Here. So, well, he said, "Where have you laid him?" Jesus, deeply moved, "Where have you laid him? Lord, come and see." And then there's this expression, "And God wept." Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is God. Jesus is man. He's both. And God weeps. The literal translation here might be better understood as Jesus burst into tears. Have you ever burst into tears? Have you? Yes. So, sometimes we burst into tears because we see the depth of loss in others, and that moves us. So, The least we can say here is then Jesus, God is moved by our sense of loss. Right? Okay. Yes. As if he didn't know? All right. So why did he ask? Where did you lay him?
Do you think it was just like an accompanying thing to be?
Oh. Jesus obviously has... I'm trying to answer your question. Jesus can read into the intents of the hearts. That I have evidence from the text. But when Jesus became man, did he give up some of the attributes of the divine? Even if temporarily. I'm asking a question. He doesn't know for sure when the second coming is. Is that right? He doesn't know. Only God knows, he says. I don't know. And that's one instance where I'm given some hint that he gave up some divine... So, I don't know where else to go. Yes, Jim. Sure. So I think you're saying, thinking as Brother Hatcher, he is moved by the sense of loss of those around him. Is that correct? What I'm asking is, does he have a sense of loss? Or is there any difference? Yes. Thank you, Josh.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So he has he doesn't understand just Mary and Martha's loss and the neighbors of Lazarus. He understands the loss of all human beings, including yours and mine and the people in Searcy today. He understands it. And for that he weeps. Yes, sir. You couldn't hear in the back, Brother Melvin says, why do we assume that for God, human death is less, means less, because he knows that he can put our bodies back together and reconstitute us. Why would physical death be less for God? What if it's more? What if for God our physical death is more of a loss than even for us? Okay? Good. He wept. Verse 36. So the Jews said, see how he loved him. The people around are struck by God's crying. Now, do they recognize he's God? Some of them may, many of them didn't. Verse 37, but some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have also kept this man from dying? Notice here, kept this man from dying. Kept this man from dying. Very important distinction here. Stop me if you have a comment or a question. Then Jesus deeply moved again. John is going to double down again. Maybe you didn't catch it before. Jesus deeply moved again, came to the tomb, and it was a cave and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. So here is a first century tomb. This one's in Jerusalem, and it is of the kind of a wealthier people. The tradition for about 80 years in the first century was that you would wrap a body in linens, a big sheet, the whole body, and then one over the head, two sheets, plural. That's recorded in the account of of Christ as well. And then you would put it in one of these. You would seal it with a gigantic stone. The stone is missing here, but there's a trough right in front in which you would roll it. And then it would be very hard to move. And why would you want to go there anyway? You would leave the body for approximately a year so that the full decomposition of the material parts, except for the bones, were done. It's cool inside those stone caves. It talks about a cave in the text here. But still, the decomposition process begins immediately. They did not do like the Egyptians and take the innards out and take the brain out through the nostrils. They did not do mummification process. Not in first century, not in Israel. And they just simply wrapped them in those linens. And sometimes they would put lime and other things around to keep, if you had to go back in and bury somebody else in a family tomb before, and keep from knocking yourself out from the odor of decomposition. I have not experienced human decomposition to that point, but I've experienced sheep decomposing in Egypt. Ran into a decomposing body of a sheep in a hole in the land of Moses, in the land of Goshen, and about knocked me silly. Just whoa. Some of you may have been from farm, you're more used to that, but and I told my students, stay away, something's dead here. 4 days in Palestine, even with the coolness of the cave, is sufficient. So there is the setting. Go back to that text. Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory? So they took away the stone. By the way, after a year, you take it out, and the bones are the only thing left, and you put it in a bone box. So we have thousands of bone boxes that we used in the first century so they could reuse the bed on which you lay the body to decompose. This is the practice of this society in that time. When he had said these things, verse 43, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. So open tomb, Jesus outside, body of Lazarus inside, wrapped all in linens like a mummy, but not mummified, 4 days. The man who had died came out, says John. Hands and feet bound with linen strips, his face wrapped in a cloth. And Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. So, go to Luke chapter 19. Go to Luke chapter 19. I don't have it on the screen, so I'm asking you to use your Bibles and your digital Bibles. And remind yourself that there is another instance of Jesus weeping that's recorded by Luke about 30 years before. And it's in chapter 19 and verse 41. And so Jesus is approaching Jerusalem in the context. Luke 19 and verse 41. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, here's the Jesus wept over it. Same Greek word. He wept over it. Not just expression of feelings, he wept. This time he's weeping for all of Jerusalem. He wept for the people, not the... Jesus will say to the apostles, don't put your heart in the temple, and by the way, the city of Jerusalem too, because, and he doesn't say 40 years from now, but he says within one generation, that's the implied words, it's all going to be gone. Of course, he's talking in the year 2930, and he's talking about what the Romans are going to do in 70 AD. Jesus does know that. Don't put your heart in the temple. It's going to be obliterated by the Roman legions in between May and September of the year 70 AD. 40 years from now, one generation, it's going to be gone. But Jesus is not weeping for the city, but he's weeping for the people. 200,000 people. Jesus weeps not for just one. He weeps for 200,000 and for everything that Jerusalem represents. You know, it's supposed to be the house of God, the city of God, the city of David. And yet, most of them are lost. Lost. Here it's weeping for the destruction that's going to come upon them. We're not sure about the casualties. I found one guy exaggerating today in my studies. I said 1 million people died in the siege of 70 AD. That's not possible. That's an exaggeration. But when the Romans took Jerusalem in 63 before Christ, there were about 12,000 casualties. The casualties, as recorded by the historian Josephus in 70 AD, the casualties, those are going to die of starvation, of disease, of war, are in the tens of thousands. Okay, Jesus weeps. Is he weeping just for the fact that in 40 years they're going to be destroyed? I don't think so. I think he's weeping here for the spiritual condition. Jesus weeps for the spiritual condition. Now, I go back now to John chapter 11. He's not weeping for the spiritual condition of Lazarus, or he's weeping for the death, the loss, the sense of grief there, okay? In this instance, here are some just suggestions, and you gave some better ones. He's weeping for his loss, say some, but if he knew that he would raise him in a few minutes, how far does that go? Was it the pain of others, I asked you? And of course it is, but is there more than that? Was it the lack of faith that he saw in others? He had seen the lack of faith. Oh, you of little faith. He'd seen it before in his apostles and others, and he had not wept. But this instance, there's weeping that accompanies lack of faith. So that doesn't seem to be the answer. Maybe it is what Melvin suggested. That is, we assume that God does not feel human death, physical death, because he is the God of life and resurrection. We assume that, but perhaps that's not true. Perhaps I can't get a straight answer to my question. It is true that physically sometimes we weep and we don't know why. I'm not going to assume that of Jesus here, but sometimes we do. There's just this, like, we can't put it in words. Tears don't always think, but they are human, and Jesus is human. And he's weeping for human sorrow. Both times that Jesus weeps. Yeah. Okay. So, God, the true God, the living God, is not irrational, violent, and doesn't care a lick for our losses. He not only cares, but he comes down and he cries. That's our God. That's the true God. So, reason number 732, the true God is better than man-made gods. That's always the case, okay? So what's the most amazing part? That Lazarus was raised, or that Jesus wept? If you were given us... both of these seem to be extraordinary moments in John chapter 11, reasons for which we thank God and we thank John for giving us insight into this very important event in the life of Christ, the life of the Son of God that came down to earth. Okay. Anything else? Yes, sir. Jim? So he's for sure a prophet. And the other two characteristics of a Messiah are priest and king. Of course, king, they're going to pronounce him when he comes in on the donkey. What's he doing on a donkey? Prophet, priest, and king. Once you put all those three together, shouldn't you... How hard should it be from a Sunday to a Friday to turn from Hail, King of... Son of David, to crucify him, crucify him. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, but it's what we do sometimes. All right, Jesus washes feet. Go to chapter 13, well-known context to you, and let's go there, first 17 verses. Jesus weeps and Jesus washes feet. Yes, sir, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
4 days
is very operative. Yes, sir. 4 days is important.
The Jews at that time believed that the Spirit hovered until the fourth day.
So a reminder to you that there's nothing accidental about Jesus delaying going there. He's a day away when he gets the news. He's going to wait 2 days to go, going to get there, and he's going to already be buried because they buried people immediately because they had no refrigeration, no. So bodies were entombed immediately because they started the decay process. So it's not just three. Three was a misunderstanding of the Jews with regard to death, that the spirit hovered around for 3 days and then finally departed. Spirit departed, couldn't come back after 4 days. And clearly after 4 days, there's decomposition, there's odor, all of those things. But more importantly, there's been separation of the body from the spirit. And if you can bring back somebody that's been in the tomb 4 days, then what? That's the question. So thank you, Brother McKee. Anything else? All right, he washed their feet. I knew that already, didn't you? But how extraordinary is it? Extraordinary. It, after 3 years of being with them, everything they've seen and experienced, it surprises the apostles, and even Peter doesn't know what to do with it. Okay, he doesn't know what to do with it. So there are those that make this narrative come alive, practice feet washing, whether once or more than once. They do it so that we won't just read it and intellectually say, yeah, and that happened one day. That'll be more. The setting, of course, I'll remind you, actually the word that's used in John chapter 13 is reclining. So what you see, one of the many ways in which the setting, they're not like in Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, all seated at the table on one side with Jesus in the middle, six apostles on one side, six on the other. That's not the setting. That's what Leonardo da Vinci did in the early 1500s. But the real setting was a Roman triclinium, and here you have one of the ways in which a Greco-Roman living room was actually set up. So you had normally servants that would serve in between a U-shaped table, and they were reclining on couches. They would either have already some form of, not table, but a place where you would put the food that would go around. This is more like the setting of John 17, and let me again go here. Here's the text, the setting. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Wow. He loved them to the end. I could spend the rest of the class on that one. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, he tied it around his waist. And then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel that he had wrapped around them. Did you discover any details in rereading it one more time that you had forgotten or not caught before? So it's just before the Passover, biggest feast in the calendar of the year of the Jews, and there are three Passovers in the ministry of Jesus. That's why we say that Jesus' ministry lasted 3 years. And on the Passovers, he left Galilee, always went down to Jerusalem to celebrate it there. It was an 8-day festivity, and it was a big thing. And they didn't have weekends like we have, but they did have, of course, Shabbat, as Jews did. They were the only ones in the world to have Saturday as a whole very important rest day. At least they were supposed to. And then they had these holidays. They didn't have 4th of July. They didn't have, you know, Labor Day. They didn't have, they were all religious, their holidays, all religious. This one was the big one. And it's this one that drives Jesus and the apostles from Galilee down to Judea. There's been a conversation. Go to Matthew chapter, please, 20 and verse 20. Go there, please. I'm going to read it because I guess the setting, well, John doesn't tell you, Matthew does tell you that there had been some contention. Now, you know this story. The immaturity of the apostles is only matched by ours at times. Here's 3 years later, Still some growing up to do, still some understanding to be had. Matthew chapter 20, verse 20 starts with, the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. This is what conversation is happening on the road into Jerusalem. What is it you want? Jesus asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your side and the other at your left in your kingdom. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I am going to drink? Now, I have suggested before in other contexts, watch out this last statement here. He's answering the mother of James and John, sons of Zebedee. She is a follower of Jesus. She's among many women that are in the entourage of Jesus. Mary Magdalene's one of them. There are many women that serve and help. I don't know what else they do. I suppose they make food too for the entourage of Jesus that's going here. She comes up to him and she knows that something's about to happen, something big. And she says, could you give my sons the vice president positions? And he looks at her in the eyes. He looks at her in the eyes and says, you don't have a clue what you're asking. And then he turns to James and John and says, can you guys go where I'm going? One answer is to the mother, and the other one's to the sons. He looks in the eyes of the two brothers. Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? Can you go where I'm going? And they say, we can. And by the way, they will. James will be the first to die. The apostles beheaded about 12 years from here. And John, we're not sure, they will remain faithful and either die martyrs or not, but die in the faith, for the faith. They're going to drink the cup. They say, we can, okay? So that's what's going on. And of course, in the aftermath, look at verse 24. When the other apostles find out that James and John's mother asked for the vice president positions in his kingdom, when the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. But of course they were. No. They should have said, oh, James, John, what were you thinking? That's what you want to be, the, you know, in the inner circle of the kingdom of heaven, you know, they're going to here on earth. So that's the conversation, okay? So that's what, and that's what leads into the room, and the Passover is being had, and they lay down on the couches and they're about to eat. So there's been this contentious conversation about who gets to be vice president in the kingdom of heaven that's coming up right before, okay? And then they're eating, and then suddenly, in the middle of the meal, he gets up. Correct me if I'm reading it wrong. And there are some servants normally. I look at the images again. These are prints and paintings of various descriptions of this, not according to the Leonardo da Vinci model of Lord's Supper, but according to a Greco-Roman triclinium. Triclinium means three couches, okay? So you see the U-shaped, with servants that can bring the food from the interior, so that seems to be more the setting in which you have. Here's another one. It could be that they didn't have a table, or that maybe this is also a possibility. Doesn't really matter. As long as we get away from the people sitting behind a table image, then we are understanding better what's going on logistically here. And suddenly Jesus, who's at the head of the three triclinium table, gets up and he begins doing what he did. This is where the journey has been. The conversation about who's going to be the vice president happens on the... There is Jerusalem, and there's a little dot right there, and that's the Mount of Olives. It's a mountain, and on the other side of the mountain is Bethany. That's where the raising of Lazarus had just taken place, and it's just a few miles over the mountain into downtown Jerusalem. So what on earth is the purpose here? What's the purpose? Okay, so suggestions. And you, please make this list better. Disagree, add to it. Which one do you find more meaningful? Why did you do this? Well, there are some symbolism, obviously, here. There's some symbolism in this act. Because, of course, we're nearing the cross. He's nearing the cross. They're still distracted. He does it to prepare them for his death. He's got to do something that they don't expect him to do. He's told them, when we go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be betrayed. He's told them, but that hasn't sunk in. So here's another moment in which he makes them feel uncomfortable more than once, catches them off guard. He's done that for many times. And it's about sacrifice, and he's going to do that in a much greater way, of course, by going to a cross there, okay? The water could be a symbol of cleaning. What's going to clean us, clean men from sin, is not water. It's going to be blood. But there is water that becomes baptism for the remission of sins, not the baptism of John, but from the moment that he's resurrected and the birth of the church, baptism in the name of Christ. And we remember that sacrifice today, and it's the blood that cleanses us. So it could be that that is an important symbol as well. It definitely says, okay, my kingdom is going to be different than the kingdoms of men, because kings do not wash the feet of their servants. They just don't. Not in his time, and I'm not sure they do it in our time either. Okay? So Christian, the Christian, the follower of Christ is going to have to think in different terms completely. Okay? So, I have one question for you. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. They have just walked from Bethany. They have not had a chance to wash their feet, evidently. It was evidently supposed to happen, but there weren't enough servants to do it. There weren't any servants that had done it. That's the point. That's just a matter of fact. It hadn't been done. And they had walked over the Mount of Olives. So there's a physical side, but you're also saying it could be also, this is the beginning of something new. This is the beginning of something new, okay? Anything else? Yes. No, the feet was customary, but it's customary for servants, slaves to do it. And I don't know why there weren't any slaves there to do it, any servants to do it. Ah. Oh, there were some servants. So instead of being vice presidents, you should be doing, you should have offered to wash each other's feet when we got in here, right?
Whenever I look at that passage, I just think to myself, the last person in the room should have been washing feet was Jesus.
The last person in the room to be washing feet should have been Jesus.
I mean, when you look at their position with respect to one another, he says, you call me your
master. First shall be last, last shall be first. We're not doing it the human way. We're doing it the God way. Brother Bob, I'm sorry.
The occasion that they were walking on the road, I don't know if it was the same one, but they were arguing among themselves, not just the two, but all of them, arguing about who would have choice of position. He used that, told them about the Gentiles and their rulers, and that it would not be so. But really, there was only one servant in the room.
There was only one servant in the room that day. So here's the question. Did we come with a servant spirit and attitude to this day, to this moment, to this worship? What's our attitude? It's been good to be together.